Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Begin again.
It is good to be back in Iowa.
Less than 100 delegates to go, and Barack Obama returns to where his campaign began. After winning Oregon, the Democratic nomination seems to be a matter of simple arithmetic. But there's nothing simple about November. Coming to grips with the new math of the November election. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, May 21st. It is the strange logic of the electoral college that rules when the November campaign begins. How does that change strategy? Also, South Africa's brutal struggles over immigration. Everybody talks about the price of gasoline, but who's making money? And a giant of American politics faces one more very public battle. Teddy, how well do we know you? That and all the news. Another split decision, but Barack Obama has taken an insurmountable lead in pledged delegates. He won big in Oregon and lost big in Kentucky to Hillary Clinton, who sounded undaunted last night.
I'm going to keep making our case until we have a nominee, whoever she may be.
While Senator Clinton says she's determined to see every vote count, her victory speech in Louisville sounded a conciliatory note. Meanwhile, Obama's presidential campaign has more than $37 million in the bank, according to Federal Election Commission filings yesterday. They show he raised more than $31 million last month. That's $9 million more than Clinton and $13 million more than Republican John McCain.
Ted Kennedy's wife, Vicky, says the diagnosis that the Massachusetts senator has a cancerous brain tumor has pitched the family, quote, a real curveball. In an email to friends, she promised a fight, saying, "This is only the first inning."
9 days after a 7.9 earthquake in China, rain and lack of tents are adding to the misery of 5 million people left homeless. As the recovery effort continues, more schools are reopening in the disaster zone. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is headed to cyclone-ravaged Myanmar tomorrow.
My aim in going to Myanmar is to, first of all, demonstrate my sympathy to the people and government at this time of crisis and challenge, and to see for myself the situation on the ground.
Myanmar's state media says the country is refusing U.S. military relief supplies for cyclone victims because of the strings attached. However, the government says U.S. non-military aid is welcome.
Honda says it's betting on hybrids for the U.S. car market. A new lighter, lower-priced green car will go on sale in the U.S. and Europe next year. Crude oil gushed into record territory again today in Asian trading, breaking above $130 a barrel. The U.S. markets closed down yesterday, and the Nikkei followed suit today, down 233 points. And with these high oil prices, you're likely to feel it most, of course, at the gas pump. What if gasoline was $5 a gallon?
And that's what we're asking you. If it was, you would no longer do what?
Fill in the blank. How would it change your life? Here's one answer.
Hi, this is Jennifer Brookman from Fairlawn, New Jersey. When gas hits $5 a gallon, I'm going to start looking for a job closer to home. Thank you.
That's a huge shift.
Yeah, go to the Takeaway Classifieds to find a job for our Spinbox contestant. Anyway, you can call 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Put us within reach of the Democratic nomination for President of the United States of America.
For the sake of our country, the Democrats must take back the White House and end Republican rule.
Good morning, everybody. Two more primary contests in Oregon and Kentucky, two different outcomes and two different themes from the two candidates. Barack Obama, who points out that he's now within 70 delegates of the nomination, and Hillary Clinton, who wants all the votes counted but claims she will fight for the Democratic nominee, whoever she or he may be. Joining us now is the Takeaway's political director, Andrea Bernstein. Different themes from the candidates, but it seems like the outcome is fairly clear from here on out.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost as if Clinton did not win Kentucky by a landslide, which she did, 35 points, to 16 points to Obama's Oregon victory. States both about the same size and population. But the delegate math is so against her, even if she gets her way on the Florida and Michigan delegates, that it's almost as if the only reason she's staying in is if somehow Obama collapses in the next 2 weeks.
But how powerful is this argument? As we get closer to November, or closer to the conventions, the issue of her not winning is less important than she came so close, because that's relevant to the viability of the Obama candidacy in the fall. How does that play out mathematically and strategically?
Well, they are both looking at different electoral maps were they to become the nominee. Hillary Clinton would be relying much more on states like West Virginia, Florida. Of course, now, you know, a general election is completely different. There's none of this proportional allocation, which has made the Democratic race so close. I mean, if they were Republicans, the race would be over by now, because Republicans have winner-take-all in the primaries,
right,
which is the same model as the general election. The Obama people are saying, you know, we are going to win states like Virginia, Minnesota, some of the upper Midwest states that have gone Republican in recent years. So they're saying we're creating new math.
And what's interesting, just to follow up on John's question about strategy, what I found really interesting about Clinton's speech last night was her very conciliatory tone. Let's take a quick listen to another soundbite.
Whatever happens, I'll work as hard as I can to elect a Democratic president this fall. We will come together as a party, united by common values and common cause.
She said things of this nature repeatedly, and you've been covering her for a long time through the Senate races, through this presidential primary process. What does that say to you?
Well, Hillary Clinton also said during that speech in the clip that we heard at the top that we have to have the strongest candidate. And she still believes she is the strongest candidate, and that's why she wants to win, because she wants to take back the White House. But there's nothing in her history to suggest that she's a bad Democrat and would sabotage the Obama campaign.
Right.
A message to her supporters, really? Because there's been a lot of discussion in the past week, particularly about how her supporters are saying that if Obama becomes the Democratic nominee come fall, they're going to vote for John McCain.
I think it is a message to her supporters. And I think that if you look at the primary race she's run, coming almost to the nomination, raising huge amounts of money. I mean, in April, when Hillary Clinton was losing, she raised more money than John McCain, who is the Republican nominee. And the Republicans are traditionally the party that has raised the most money.
Well, and that's the most unambiguous math of all, the financing dollars here. I mean, Barack Obama, there's no doubt who's in the lead there.
Together, the Democrats raised almost three times as much money as John McCain. So even with a divided party, the Democrats, by one measure, are doing better than the Republicans.
Obama, and we should point out, it's more than $250 million, both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama.
I mean, we've already seen the Republican attack machine coming out this morning. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani on TV attacking Obama's foreign policy. Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman writing in the Wall Street Journal. They have their big guns out. But Obama has a lot of money. When you have that much money, you do get to control the message to some extent.
And you already see some hints of what message Obama is going to take in November. Here is something that he spoke about last night.
Change is a tax code that rewards work instead of wealth, by cutting taxes for middle-class families and senior citizens and struggling homeowners, a tax code that rewards businesses that create good jobs here in America instead of the corporations that ship them overseas. That's what change is.
Is that going to work, unite the party and be powerful in November quickly?
Well, that's his hope, because he has to get those working-class, middle-class voters, and the argument he has to make is that the Bush years have been unfair to the majority of Americans.
Political director for The Takeaway, Andrea Bernstein, stay with us. We're going to talk with David Axelrod of the Obama campaign in a moment and get your reaction to that. But we change our focus now to the other big story in Washington. Weekend news that Ted Kennedy suffered a seizure was alarming, but the disturbing and sober news that he's been diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor really sent shockwaves across the nation's capital, and especially in the Senate, where Ted Kennedy has served as the senator from Massachusetts for more than 45 years.
My thoughts and my humble prayers are with Senator Kennedy, my dear friend Ted.
That's a very emotional West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd, the only more senior senator there in that body in Washington than Edward Kennedy. Joining me is Kevin Cullen, columnist for the Boston Globe. Kevin, most people in Massachusetts grew up with the Kennedys, watched Teddy Kennedy stand in for his older brothers during times of tragedy. With this diagnosis for Ted, what do you think is going on both in the New England kind of Kennedy clan and in the Senate where there is so much emotion today?
Well, John, I mean, the Kennedys have been down this road before when it comes to tragedy. They tend to turn inward and surround each other, and it's obviously a big clan. It's interesting. It's a very sober reaction here because, you know, it's not just about the Kennedys, but I think every single family in this region, as in the rest of the United States, has been touched by this. I think it's impossible to go through an American family and not find some family member that has been touched or by cancer. And so there's a political reaction, and there's also a human reaction, and I think people are very, very sobered by all this.
What's the latest from Mass General Hospital as far as the family is waiting for news from the doctors as to what the therapy options are? What do you know at this point?
Well, I mean, it's pretty. It's what we know about this disease, and as they, you know, I'm not a doctor, and I don't even play one on TV. But this is pretty basic stuff. It's chemo and it's radiation, and the most concerning thing is that Ted's age. This is not, you know, the prognosis tends to not be good as you go up the age chart. So, but the other thing is that the invariables here is that, you know, Ted Kennedy has always been a fighter. I mean, since he was a little kid. I did a column the other day when he first fell ill and pointed out that last year I went through his mother's papers. Rose Kennedy's papers were unsealed, and I went through them, and I found this great little tidbit that when he was like 6 or 7 years old, when he lived in London, when his dad was the ambassador there, some English kid, a bully, kept teasing him and kept smacking him or whatever. So he turned to his Irish nanny, his governess, Luella Hennessy, and asked his, for permission to smack the English kid. And according to Rose's diary, Luella Hennessy said, "Go for it." So Teddy's always been a fighter.
A fighter.
He's fought through a lot of different things.
A fighter with a family mandate. Quickly, then, do you expect him to stay in the Senate as long as he possibly can, despite the therapy options?
Absolutely. But I think it's anyone's guess, John, frankly, what physically he'll be able to do. And the other thing is, you know, Teddy's doctor, Larry Rona, is a good friend of mine. And what Larry tells Teddy to do, Teddy, I think, will do. So, you know, there's so many invariables here and unknowns. So, but it's a lot will become a lot clearer in the next couple of weeks.
Both in Washington and in New England and around the nation. Kevin Cullen, columnist for the Boston Globe, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
They are waiting their options there in Massachusetts. And just to remind you all, we have a takeaway question that has nothing to do with the Kennedys, but we urge you to respond to anything that's going on in the program. You can go to our website at mytake@thetakeaway.org and leave your responses, your reminiscences, your condolences for the Kennedy family, and also answer this question. When gasoline gets to $5 a gallon, what is it that you stop doing? Fill in the blank.
Christina in New York tells us, "I will still not use a car. I live in Manhattan and rely on mass transportation. Luckily, mass transit has improved during my 14-year tenure in Manhattan. It sure was crappy in the early 90s, she adds.
Of course, and lots of places around the country don't have the option for mass transit. I'm going to have to pay those gas bills. Again, you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your fill in the blank for $5 gas. How does your life change? Or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the chief strategist for the Barack Obama campaign. But first, we're going to have some headlines. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. He won one in Oregon and lost one in Kentucky, but it was a triumphant-sounding Barack Obama last night speaking in, of all places, Iowa.
The skeptics predicted we wouldn't get very far. The cynics dismissed us as a lot of hype and a little too much hope. And by the fall, the pundits in Washington had all but counted us out. But the people of Iowa had a different idea.
Iowan's different idea has become the presumptive frontrunner, possibly the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party, Barack Obama. And the chief political strategist for Barack Obama is David Axelrod, who joins us live this morning. Thanks for joining us. Congratulations. You have a majority of pledged delegates. It would appear that your status as nominee is assured, barring any sort of radical change of the superdelegates. How much of a problem is it that Hillary Clinton appears determined to stay in the race?
Well, it's really not a problem, John. I believe that Senator Clinton believes deeply in the Democratic Party, this country, and I think she knows how desperately we change direction. And I think she will support the nominee of the party and campaign for us, and I think we're going to have unity very, very soon.
If you do have unity, though, what do you make of her argument that Barack Obama is weak in the states that Democrats have to win?
Well, I think that there's polling that belies that. There was just a poll out in Pennsylvania the other day that showed Obama leading by 8 or 9 points. I think the truth of it is that the economic situation in our country right now is such that working-class Americans all across the country are desperate for change. They know that these Bush policies are failing. They also know that Senator McCain has embraced them in total, and that to vote for McCain is to vote for more of the same. That's not going to happen. I think we're going to have a great movement for change sweep this country in November.
Since you're dealing with an electoral college map and not a delegate map anymore as you look towards November, do you start from square one when you design a strategy to go up against John McCain?
Well, I think that we're going to stretch the electoral map, John. We were in the state of Oregon last night. We won in the state of Oregon last night, a landslide victory. And we've won victories in states throughout the country that I think are considered swing states. Iowa is another one. The Republicans won last time where we're leading now, and I believe we're going to win. So I think we're going to win the big states that Democrats need to win and have traditionally won, states like Pennsylvania. But I also think we're going to add states. Colorado is a good example that the Democrats haven't won, and we're going to cobble together a great new majority.
And David, in terms of themes, last night in Kentucky, one of the things that Barack Obama has struggled with is attracting white working class voters. So moving forward, how do you plan to address issues that they are concerned about most more directly? Because the numbers are pretty startling in terms of the percentage that Hillary Clinton has managed to capture versus that of Barack Obama.
Well, that those numbers vary, of course, from state to state. Even last night, the numbers were much different in Oregon among that same category of voter as they were in Kentucky. But the larger point is when you look at general election polling, there isn't a great deal of difference between how Senator Clinton and Senator Obama are polling among that particular group of voters. And the reason is that, as I said before, they're the people who know
the most how much these Republican policies have let us down. When Senator McCain says he's going to embrace the Bush economic nostrums, I think they know that that's not the direction we need to go. And so I believe that at the end of the day, we're going to have a unified base, and it's going to include working-class Americans who so desperately want change.
David, let me ask you something about your candidate. You and I both have experience in Chicago. It's said that Barack Obama learned at the hand of watching one of the most decisive and strategic politicians of all time, Harold Washington, the mayor of Chicago. But Barack Obama is a University of Chicago professor. Once he gets into the full Klieg lights of the campaign, is he going to be a decisive leader, or is he going to be more a ruminating kind of intellectual? And how will that play as we get into November?
Well, all I would say, John, is that we've been one of the advantages we have of being involved in the longest nominating struggle in history against one of the most tenacious opponents one could ever have. I think that we have a battle-tested candidate. He's been faced with a lot of challenges in this race and a very challenging opponent, and run against the most well-established and well-practiced political operation in the Democratic Party, and he's winning. And there's a reason for that. There is a steel, a metal, a determination to this man. He ran because he fundamentally believed that this country was on the wrong track, that our politics was letting down the American people, and he was determined to change it. And I don't think he's going to be deterred.
Certainly, Hillary said, Barack Obama wasn't vetted at the beginning of this campaign. I think it may be safe to say that he's vetted to a certain extent now. David Axelrod, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, great to be with you.
Chief Strategist for the Barack Obama campaign, David Axelrod. Andrea Bernstein, Takeaway Political Director, your reaction.
Well, it's interesting that we just spoke with Barack Obama, chief strategist, and we are facing perhaps the first African-American or biracial Democratic nominee ever. But the issue of race was not raised, even with the question of the sort of white working class voters. And I think that that is going to be a very interesting thing to watch in the general election, if indeed, as it looks, Barack Obama is the nominee, is how is race going to be used? How is it going to be used by the Republicans? How is it going to be used by the Democrats? They want to talk not about race, but about economics.
And you can hear that in Axelrod. You can hear that in Barack Obama's statement
exactly.
last night.
Exactly. That's the discussion they want to have. I do think that there are some interesting trends. Barack Obama had 75,000 people in Portland, Oregon last weekend. That's usually the number that you get in November. That's filling a football stadium.
So it's Rolling Stones numbers.
When they say, there's a phenomenon here, I think that one of the interesting things is the Republicans are sort of gleefully looking at Barack Obama saying, we can make mincemeat out of this guy. And, Reverend Wright, the whole question of Muslim, we haven't, you haven't seen anything yet. But Hillary Clinton learned that Barack Obama is a pretty formidable candidate. She was the front runner for a long time until people actually started voting.
Do you think this campaign has inoculated him, Adora, against the issue of race in November?
Oh, absolutely not. I don't know how that could ever happen in a country where it is such a divisive and contentious and problematic and troubling issue.
More drama as we head to November. Thank you, Andrea Bernstein, Takeaway Political Director.
Thank
we'll
you.
Be right back.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. On this Wednesday, May 21st, we have the headlines from Femi. Okay, Femi?
Coming up to 27 minutes to the hour, making news today, Barack Obama says he's within reach of being the Democratic presidential nominee. Crude oil is selling at more than $130 a barrel, and Israel confirms that it's holding peace talks with Syria. Also making news in the Middle East today, Lebanon's government and the opposition party say they've reached an agreement to end 18 months of political conflict. I've just been speaking to the BBC's Jim Muir in Beirut, where the Lebanese are being cautiously optimistic.
What it means absolutely right this minute is that the tented encampment with which Hezbollah and its allies have been physically besieging the headquarters here in downtown Beirut of the Western-backed government, that is now being dismantled. I'm looking out the window here and seeing them physically pulling down these tents and barbed wire that have been a feature of our life here in central Beirut for the last 18 months. Now, that camp really symbolized the deadlock that has paralyzed political life in the country and indeed much of the economic life in the surrounding area of downtown Beirut, causing a lot of economic damage. So now that it's being dismantled, I think after this 18-month period, I think many Lebanese will be encouraged to think that there has indeed been a significant breakthrough.
What does this whole deal mean? What's the relevance to most Americans?
The message we're getting here is that America's influence here has been slightly dented. America supports this Western-backed government, which has had to give quite a bit of ground. It's a fairly balanced solution.
And that was the BBC's Jim Muir speaking to me just a few minutes ago from Beirut, Lebanon. And the Arab League, when they brokered the deal, John and Adora, they have a phrase in Lebanon, no victor, no vanquished. So basically, there's no winner in this situation. Everybody wins.
Except the Hezbollah gets a veto of the government.
Well, they get a lot of what they wanted. They got a lot of package. And they also got about a third of the seats in their government, which is exactly what they wanted. There also is likely to be a presidential election. That's happening this Sunday with General Michel Suleiman. And Lebanon will finally get a president after 6 months of waiting.
Incredible. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
Thank you very much. And we're going to move to South Africa right now, where there have been many violent days recently. 23 people are dead. Hundreds are injured. Those are the reports coming out of South Africa, where the experts and government officials and victims are blaming anti-immigrant sentiment. There's all kinds of reports about violent mobs patrolling Johannesburg's, club-wielding South Africans attacking men and women, demanding to know where they are from. Why? Because the targets are tens of thousands of immigrants and refugees. They come from the Congo, Mozambique, and most recently, thousands of Zimbabweans who have been running from the political crisis in their own country. You put this together with rough economic times, and this is what many say has led to the violence there. And right now, joining us to discuss the latest events is Mpho Lekechi. And how did this all begin? Why don't we start there?
Well, this whole thing began over a week ago in a township called Alexandra in northern Johannesburg. Basically, community members there had held a meeting aimed at discussing the crime situation in that particular township. Now, some of the community members suggested that foreigners or immigrants in that township are behind the recent spate of crimes in that area. As a result, many people suggested that all foreigners should be chased out of that township. And obviously that escalated to the national tragedy that we're seeing at the moment.
And Mpho, you are covering this story for the BBC, and the stories are horrific. We heard from one man who said that he was in church worshiping and that the church was surrounded by a gang of armed people. We've heard about buildings that were shut down and set fire, holding families inside. So you're saying just in this very short period of time, those words have led to those actions.
Absolutely. In fact, at the weekend, I was in a suburb known as Cleveland, near the Johannesburg city center, and I saw there a man believed to be from Zimbabwe being hit with stones and bricks and fighting sticks. With bystanders saying, "Well, there's no problem. Such things should happen because these people should be driven out of South Africa because they are the ones that are responsible, for all the problems that South Africa has." But obviously, not all South Africans feel that way. And one of the things that is very important to mention is that even some South Africans have been affected by the violence, because some people, from not from Johannesburg, but people from other parts of the country have also been targeted.
And we're talking about problems like unemployment rate somewhere around 30%. You're talking about food shortages, and you're talking about attacks not necessarily on those who have just come to the country, but some of these people, like someone we spoke to earlier, has been working in South Africa for many, many years, but these gangs of young men are not making any distinction.
Absolutely. But you see, the problem now is even the politicians themselves have been saying that there are criminal elements that are taking advantage of the situation. Indeed, many people are complaining about poor service delivery on the side of the government. But also, you know, the problem now is with the criminals who are taking advantage. I was in the township of Soweto earlier today, and some of the business people have been saying to me that the problem now is that they have to close their doors. They have to be very careful because some people will be pretending to be targeting criminals. You know, they will be coming to these shops, looting them, robbing them, you know, obviously pretending to be targeting criminals. So it's a situation that has really, you know, gotten out of hand. But authorities have been saying that they're trying their best. Even the army has said that, you know, it will try and assist in terms of giving weapons to the police so that they can be able to
try and assist. How is President Mbeki handling this? Has he come out and spoken publicly? Does he have some kind of plan to how to address this conflict?
Well, yesterday we tried, when I say we, the BBC tried to get in touch with President Thabo Mbeki's office, but they made it very clear to us that they will not speak to the BBC. I'm not sure if that, you know, has to do with you know, something different from what is currently happening. But basically what I'm trying to say is President Thabo Mbeki has been quiet. Many people have been very critical of him. Of course, there are, you know, members of his cabinet who have visited the townships, places that have been affected, but the president himself hasn't been there. He hasn't really said anything decisive in connection with dealing with the situation.
So what's the expectation as to what might perhaps dampen things? If you're talking about, on one hand, it is a result of the tensions or the feelings of resentment against immigrants. And then the other hand, you're also talking about criminal or hooligans or elements that are taking advantage of the situation. Then where does it end?
Well, that's the problem. Even, in fact, at the moment, there's no one who can really say, well, this is the core of the problem. You know, this is what is causing the problems. Because, yes, indeed, people are frustrated by slow delivery on the part of the government. But at the same time, you've got criminal elements taking advantage of the situation. Now, I've heard many politicians saying, well, this thing is political. You know, if you understand South African history, you will realize that many of the people who have been attacking people, mm-hmm. Who've been attacking the immigrants, are from the hostels. And the hostels are always known for being, you know,
yes. We're going to have to go. I'm going to have to leave it there. Umpo Lekechi, reporting for the BBC.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
As we've been reporting all morning, the Kennedy family is gathered at Massachusetts General Hospital this morning awaiting options from doctors after the diagnosis yesterday that Senator Ted Kennedy has a malignant brain tumor that is apparently not is inoperable. This, of course, is not a time for eulogies in any sense, but it is a time for reflection on the life of an individual whose most personal, private moments have been lived out in the most public way. For instance, this moment. On June 8, 1968, when young Ted Kennedy was eulogizing his brother Robert, who died in assassination.
My brother need not be idealized or enlarged in death beyond what he was in life. To be remembered simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it.
the barely concealed emotion in that speech given in 1968, certainly repeated on the floor of the Senate as people reacted to the news that Ted Kennedy has cancer of the brain. But this is the theme. This is the interesting narrative that is all of what Ted Kennedy is about. These private moments became very, very public events. Of course, perhaps the most famous, this one, in 1969, when a personal lapse became a very public scandal.
This morning I entered a plea of guilty to the charge of leaving the scene of an accident. This last week has been an agonizing one for me and for the members of my family. And the grief we feel over the loss of a wonderful friend will remain with us the rest of our lives.
The tragic death of Mary Jo Kopechne became the Chappaquiddick incident. Of course, the scandal dogged Ted Kennedy throughout his political life. Although he won his political credibility back in 1980 and actually was in a position to challenge then-incumbent President Jimmy Carter for the Democratic nomination, he won primaries in Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, and Pennsylvania, but in a very private, public moment. In an interview with Roger Mudd of CBS News, he was asked the question, why do you want to be president? He didn't really have an answer. And finally, at the convention, his candidacy, which declined from that point on, he withdrew it in an emotional moment at the convention.
The work goes on, the cause endures, the hope still lives, and the dream shall never die.
The dream of him being president perhaps did die, but the relevance of Senator Ted Kennedy never died. In fact, here he is just last week on May 8th talking about something in the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions that he couldn't have known would be so relevant.
Today, cancer is still the second highest cause of death in America. Clearly, we need a new way forward in battling this frightening disease. We must build on what the nation has already accomplished and launch a new war on cancer for the 21st century.
Again, not a moment for eulogies, but a moment to think about a person who's lived their private moments in a very, very public way. And there's probably, it's safe to say, that there's probably no one more prepared to take on this perhaps last battle than Senator Edward Kennedy. And he's waiting to determine what his next move is now at Massachusetts General Hospital. We'll be right back.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. More headlines from the Takeaway Nerve Center from Femi Oke.
Hello there, John. It's coming up to 12 minutes to the hour. Senator Hillary Clinton vows to fight on after winning yesterday's Kentucky primary. Senator Obama draws close to the finish line. He needs fewer than 100 delegates to win the Democratic nomination. Both candidates are in Florida today. Fears of a famine in Ethiopia are growing as rising food prices and drought combine to cause widespread hunger. UNICEF says 126,000 children in Ethiopia are suffering from severe malnutrition. Myanmar's military junta has given the United Nations the go-ahead to send in a few helicopters to help victims of the May the 2nd tropical cyclone. John Holmes, the United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, says the challenge for aid providers is to try to get to as many people who need help as they can.
We have reached some of them. We've by no means reached all of them. We have not reached people with enough aid yet. That's the whole purpose of the exercise, to keep on speeding up the operation, scaling it up so that we can reach people so that there are no more unnecessary deaths.
The government is still refusing help from the US military. They say it comes with strings attached. Oil and gas company executives can expect a grilling today from a Senate panel looking into rising fuel prices. Oil moved up to $130 a barrel today, and gas on average is now just short of $3.81 a gallon. And finally, to sports news. In the NBA, the Celtics have extended their at-home winning streak to 9 games. Boston took game number 1 from the Detroit Pistons in the Eastern Conference Finals last night, winning 88-79. Did you watch it? Did you stay up, John?
No. Actually, I didn't. But I checked the score first thing in the morning.
Of course.
That's right. Yeah, go Celtics. Go Celtics.
If you say so.
Yeah.
$103 a barrel.
$130.
I guess that was my delusional thinking.
It's a historical price.
That's extraordinary, but it goes straight to our question, which makes it seem as if we're a little bit ahead of the news. When gas hits $5 a gallon, we're asking you, I will stop doing blank. Here's what someone told us on our spin box. Well, I was just told we don't have the spin box.
$5
every
gallon, I'll start drinking it, I guess.
Well, what I do have is Margaret in Queens telling us, when gas hits $5 a gallon, this will cut into the activities I had planned to do with my daughters that are not within walking distance, such as going to the beach or going to the Bronx Zoo. This makes me really sad because these are the things that memories are made of. It's hard to justify spending so much money for a short afternoon of outing. I'm now told we actually do have that spin box. So can we listen to that?
Hi, my name is Mike. I'm calling from Stony Brook, New York. With already, even with gas not going up to $5 a gallon, which I'm sure it's going to soon, I spend money on gas because I have to get to work. And with the cost of groceries, my money goes towards groceries and anything else, clothes, movies, restaurants, all that extra stuff. I definitely think twice about all of that.
The extra stuff goes out the window. Here's the deal. Femi just told us that it's $3.89 an average, but if you're in Chicago, you'd be happy to pay that. $4 or above is common. It has some of the highest big city gas prices in the country. We talked to Samer Khatib, who owns 4 gas stations, and he's charging $4.39. You can't be making your customers happy. What are they saying?
Well, everybody complain about the gas price. They say it's too high. And people, they don't fill up their car anymore. They buy like $10. $10 doesn't fill them anything, like 2 gallons. It doesn't work with them. And everybody fill up his car, like put gas in his car, just a little bit to drive.
Now, wait a second, though. The oil companies have been reporting record profits, and many people probably think you're making a whole lot of money, too, but you say you're not. Explain to us why not.
Oh, you know, the gas price is not controlled by the dealer, like by the owner of the gas station. The gas price is controlled by the jobber, the wholesaler. They send us the price every day by the fax or by the email. So according to their price, we put our price 2 or 3 cents above the market. But
so you're saying that you make 2 or 3 cents on every gallon that you sell?
Yes, that's what we do. So before, when the gallon price it goes to $1, if I make 2 cents, that means I'm making 2%. But now it's $4.39. I'm making 2 cents. The percentage went down, way down.
Why is it? Very quickly explain, why is it that you have 4 gas stations, but not the prices are not the same at each one of your gas stations? Why is that?
You know, the station which one has a high price, it's because most people, they pay by the credit card. Like 90% of our customer, they pay us by the credit card. And the credit card, they charge us 2.9% plus 18 cents per transaction.
For every transaction, so therefore you're already only making a couple of cents on the gallon, and then the credit card charges eat into that. Now, this has really been affecting your life, because at the end of the day, you're really only making money on cigarettes and snacks and drinks, and people, you say, are buying less of that. And so what has that meant for your life? You have 4 kids and a wife.
Yes, I do. I have 4 kids. I have my wife. You know, the best way for us now, I am cutting all my expenses at my business, and even my wife, I told her to cut the expenses here. You know, everybody like me, even my customer, I have the old people who retired, and I have the young customer, they cut their going out. You know, everybody like to go out, but everybody cut it down.
If everyone is feeling the pain. Samer Khatib, coming to us from Chicago, the owner of 4 gas stations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
You too. And so what's really going on here? How is this all working? The prices are all over the map. You do a quick Google search, you'll find out Chicago, as we just said, over $4 a gallon. Salt Lake City, they're at $3.50 a gallon. The forces behind these regional differences range from the cost of real estate, as Samer was saying, to state taxes, to the formula that a station sells. Robert Pindyke, you there?
I'm right here.
Lots of nuances. You're a professor of economics and finance at MIT's Sloan School of Business. What is going on here?
It's very simple what's going on, and that is that the price of crude oil has gone way up. The price of crude oil has more than doubled over the last year, and crude oil is about three-quarters or more than three-quarters of the cost of producing gasoline. We use crude oil to make gasoline, to make heating oil, to make kerosene, jet fuel. And when crude oil becomes more expensive, gasoline becomes more expensive. It's that simple.
And it's skyrocketing. And you say at the end of the day, the only way to force those prices down is for us Americans to use less oil.
Well, first of all, the price of oil is determined not just by what Americans do. It's determined in the world, by the world market. Crude oil is bought and sold in a world market. So it depends on everybody's use of oil. One of the reasons why crude oil prices have become so high is that there's been a very, very large increase in demand from China, from India, from other Asian countries. And those increases in demand have not been matched by increases in supply. Supply has been pretty stagnant.
Well, I wonder what you make, then, of the big story in the Financial Times yesterday, which comes out of the Department of Energy, which suggests that a 30-year trend of rising U.S. foreign oil dependency is actually reversing because of this skyrocketing price of oil, yet it hasn't really affected the price. The U.S. foreign oil dependency is expected to fall from 60% to 50% by 2015. That's an amazing reversal.
It's actually not that big a change because you have to remember oil dependency in this country went from about 30 or 40% up to 60% over 20 years. And it's falling because, sure, when prices are very high, people will cut back on their oil consumption. One of the interesting things about gasoline is that gasoline prices actually, the surprise is not that they're as high as they are, but that they're not higher. We would have expected gasoline prices to be much higher today, and the reason is that oil prices have increased so much, as I said, they've doubled. Gasoline prices have only increased by about 40 or 50%. We would have expected them to increase a lot more, and they may yet increase more over the summer. But one of the reasons why gasoline prices have not increased that much more is because consumers are cutting back on gasoline use more than we expected. So
demand is having an impact, and price is having an impact on demand, which I guess is sort of good news as we head into the Memorial Day weekend. The consumer does have a little bit of power here.
Yeah, more than we expected. So consumers are cutting back. They're using less gas. Gasoline consumption just in the last few months has dropped about 5%.
Just very quickly, we're asking folks, when gas hits $5 a gallon, I will stop doing blank. What are you going to stop doing?
What am I going to stop doing?
Yeah.
Nothing. But some people will. I mean, some people will drive less or decide not to go on a car trip that they would have taken. And certainly what's going to happen is that when people buy new cars, there's going to be a shift towards smaller and more fuel-efficient cars.
Robert Pindyke, professor of economics and finance at MIT Sloan School of Management, John, and you heard him. He said he's not going to stop doing a thing.
Well, those MIT guys, they walk everywhere. You know? There's no place to park in Cambridge.
So. He didn't even offer that up to make it to redeem himself in some small way.
Well, you can keep filling the blank for us. When gas reaches $5 a gallon, I will no longer what? Send your answers to mytake@thetakeaway.org or 877-8-MYTAKE.
Really quickly, earlier this week, I spoke with director Pervez Sharma about his documentary, A Jihad for Love, conversation about that is going on all week, so feel free to join in there. And if you missed anything else, it's all on our podcast, available on iTunes on our website.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.